Veterans Committee on Emergency and Preparedness will come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
I always like to start the Veterans Committee with something fun or serious or sad about veterans, and I think this is sort of fun. It's called Jumping for Veterans. Marjorie Bryan and Mariana Sherman, they worked with their local chapter of the Blue Stars and Mothers of America. It's an organization made up of mothers whose kids have served in the military, as well as its Veterans Food Pantry. And they're both in their 80s, and they were committed to an act so brave it would rival those accomplished by the young men and women that they supported, the veterans. So what they did to help raise money for the vets group, that women in their 80s decided to parachute out of a plane. And so one clear June day in 2012, the two joined a team of six, as well as some retired Army Ranger paratroopers who would be guiding the women in their descent. And with more than 200 people looking on, the great-grandmothers jumped in tandem, making it safely to the ground. Bryan, for one, was jubilant, and she said she'd even consider it doing it again, all for raising money for their veterans. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Madam Vice Chair.
That was sort of fun.
Doing your first parachute jump at Benning at 80 would be a little difficult.
I know.
Just the yelling and screaming along would get to you, needless to say. colleagues, we have a very full agenda. For those members of the audience, if you haven't seen the agenda that's posted outside, we're actually to go right through the agenda. It might seem like it's long, but we try to be slightly more efficient here than elsewhere. The only change to the agenda is 10:54, which is second from the last, which has the most people signed up, will actually be heard last, and 10:55, which is last, will go back one step from in there. We've got to do, since this is sort of like dead week at college, it's end of session week, chamber week, and so we've got a bunch of business here we've got to go quickly through. Some of it will make absolutely no sense to you, but if you look at OLIS last week in the hearing, you'll understand exactly what we're doing. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on SCR 19. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 19 was previously heard on the 6th. It has it's a placeholder for memorial road signs for fallen service members. The Dash 1 Amendment recognizes and honors the Evans family of Klamath Falls, and the Dash 3 Amendment recognizes and honors Corporal Jeremy M. Lovelace. There is no fiscal and no revenue impact.
Chair Boklas, I move to adopt the Dash 1 Amendments dated 3/20/17.
Madam Vice Chair, Mona Sanders.
And the Dash 3 amendments dated 4/6/17. Sorry.
I would have corrected you, Madam Vice Chair. Madam Vice Chair, Mona Sanders moves the Dash 1 amendments dated 3/20/17 and the Dash 3 amendments dated 4/06/17 into the main bill. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Boquist, I move SCR 19 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair, Monis Anderson moves the SCR 19 with the Dash 1 and 3 amendments to the floor with a be adopted. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. Madam Vice Chair, you and I will co-carry. Since there's two parts of that, we'll close the work session SCR 19 and open a work session on SCR 20, which is Senator Byers' bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 20, previously heard also on the 6th, recognizes and honors Sergeant Brennan C. Gibson. No fiscal and no revenue.
Chair Boquist, I move SCR 20 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair, Monis Anderson moves SCR 20 to the floor with a be adopted resolution recommendation. Discussion? Opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. With that, we'll close SCR 20 and open SJM 7. Senator Beyer.
Yes.
We will open SJM 7, which, if it passes the committee, Senator Roblin will carry because it's his bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJM 7, previously heard on the 4th of April, urges Congress to permanently and adequately fund and maintain the United States Coast Guard Air Facility in Newport, Oregon. There's no fiscal and no revenue impact.
Chair Boklas, I move SJM 7 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair, Mona Sanders moves SJM 7 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there opposition? So ordered. And again, Senator Roblin is the carrier of that bill. With that, colleagues, 850, 851 don't have paperwork. We carried over till Tuesday. I see Mitch out there. I don't see the director of ODVA out there. We have a placeholder bill, SB 852. There's nothing for that bill. Mitch, do you know of anything the director has? Going once, going twice. SB 852 will be struck. It will not be carried over. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on SB 1021, which is sort of a screw-up on my part, Madam Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, appreciate your generosity, Mr. Chair. This is my inadvertent accidental attempt to kill Senator Olson's Senate Bill 320.
Almost succeeded, by the way.
Senate Bill 320 was heard on 328, just so we can connect these two records. The content was duplicated. It is identical now to the placeholder Senate Bill 1021, which has the subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means. It has a fiscal impact, and there's no revenue impact. This is the measure that appropriates $3,500,000 general fund dollars to the Oregon Military Museum for the next biennium that takes effect July 1, 2017.
Chair Boquist. I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 4-12-17.
Madam Vice Chair, Monis Anderson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 4-12-17. Is there discussion? Senator Olson, comments? Are you?
No comment. Thank you very much for.
And again, for the record, the chair inadvertently missed the original bill. And of course, we have a placeholder bill for just this case. In case the chair screws up, we have a fail-safe system and we bring in the backup. And that's what we're doing here. Is there any opposition to the Dash 1 amendment? Seeing none, so ordered. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Boquist, I move SB 1021 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Madam Vice Chair, Monis Anderson moves SB 1021 as amended with the Dash 1 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be referred to the Joint Ways Committee by prior reference. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? Are you happy, Senator Olson?
Thank you very much.
I apologize for this screw-up. Thank you. With that, since we don't need a carrier, we'll close the...
Mr. Chair, yes. You know the old motto in the military.
Buck stops here.
Stuff happens.
Stuff happens. That's not what they say.
I know that's not what they say.
Okay. With that, we're going to close the public hearing and work session on 1021. And as I mentioned, colleagues, we're actually going to hear a public hearing on 1055. We don't have any paperwork for this bill, but we'll open a public hearing on 1055 and take testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1055 expands the definition of deployment or deployed to include mobilization of a member of Armed Forces National Guard or Reserve component in specific laws affecting certain family law judgments. Permits a court to enter temporary orders allowing or requiring reasonable visitation between child of deployed parent and step-parent, grandparent, or other family member related to the child.
Madam, you're on. For the record, you are.
For the record, my name is Janet Graham, and I'm an Army veteran and a mother of two. So, and I live in Salem, Oregon. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1055. This bill came about after I lost visitation with my son after I joined the military. I had an order that would allow me to take my son with me when I went to my permanent duty station. The Oregon courts reversed that order while I was on the plane to Fort Jackson for basic training. It turned into a whirlwind 3 years of fighting to get my son back. I ended up moving back home and leaving the military, and that was what I did to get my son. The content of Senate Bill 1055 protects military members' parental rights when they're deployed. We've seen a lot of bad decisions being made by our family law courts because it seems that when the parent is deployed, all of a sudden they're not considered a parent anymore. A deployed parent is still, in every sense of the word, a parent. And the decision to join the military is made by a competent parent in the best interest of their child. The military lifestyle is perfectly fine for children. It's an honorable way to raise a family, and it's an honorable way to make a living and serve your country. And I don't think that service members should be separated from their children or denied contact with their children because of their military service. 47 states already have laws similar to this that protect military parents' parental rights when they're deployed. Oregon does not. we don't have a large military presence here visibly, but we have a large Coast Guard presence, and our National Guard is fantastic. Oregon National Guard soldiers are particularly vulnerable to this type of trauma when they're deployed. In 2009, a similar bill passed in Washington with unanimous support, and California passed its own bill protecting military families in 2012. I'm here again to support you guys passing SB 1055, and I thank you for your time and the opportunity to speak with you today, and I'd love to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair?
I'm shocked that you were denied parental rights. I mean, that just doesn't make sense to me. I'm so glad you brought this forward.
It's a very long story, Madam Vice Chair, but...
And it's not that uncommon, unfortunately,
it is
Madam
not.
Vice Chair. Senator Olson, question?
Thank you. How long was your military career then? Did it shorten it from what you planned to be?
It did. I wanted to retire from the military. I was with a great unit. I was with 5th Group. I was supporting them, and it was fantastic. I did my initial contract, which was 3 years, and then I left. I did not reenlist. So, yeah, it shortened my career.
Thank you. Good. Thank you. Thank you. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on 1055? Again, if we don't have the paperwork on this at this time, with that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 1055. We'll carry it over for the time being until next week. And with that, we're going to go back to 1054 and open a public hearing on 1054.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1054 exempts hospitals reimbursed by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs from the requirement to obtain a certificate of need from the Oregon Health Authority prior to expanding their capacity to provide inpatient psychiatric and chemical dependency services. It sunsets 2 years after the effective date, declares emergency is effective on passage. There is a dash one amendment that refines the language and separates a definition from the exemption into two subparts. It's currently in one subpart.
And colleagues, I just before we start into the testimony, the issue at hand here is primarily providing mental health care services to military service members and veterans. And the Vice Chair and I attended a meeting with our counterpart in the House trying to look at ways going forward. And one of the issues in there, and Senator, or actually representing Senator Riley, joined us at one point and has had discussions on PTSD, PTSI, as some of us like to call it. And the, for a better word, lack of services or coordination we actually have in Oregon. So that's sort of how this bill came about at the last minute. Having said that, I do have a slight conflict of interest because Greg Walker and I served in the same military unit together. So I'm going to let he and whoever colleagues he has with him go first. So Greg, if you'd join us up here, and you can bring whomever you have with you.
I always let him believe that he was in charge. My name is Greg Walker. I am a Oregon resident, have been for many years now. I'm retired military, 2005. I've submitted testimony online that you can, of course, review. I'm a wounded warrior. I went through a significant recovery and rehabilitation program here in the state of Oregon for over 3 years. Having been diagnosed with chronic combat PTSD, 2 wartime campaigns, and almost all of my service was with the Army Special Forces. I re-entered the workforce in 2009 with a DOD program for working with the most seriously injured, wounded, and ill of our Special Operations Forces, and then transitioned over to working for Cedar Hills Hospital in Portland as its first military liaison. Primarily because I found that the chemical and psychiatric treatment programs at Cedar Hills from the people that I put through for DOD were superior. And I appreciate the opportunity to come before your committee and share. And if you have any questions when I finish, please do ask them. Madam Vice Chair, I really appreciated your opening with something light. I'd like to return the favor. Martha Ray, the actress, now long deceased, unfortunately, was not only an actress and a entertainer over in Vietnam, but she was also an Army nurse. She was the first woman to become a part of Special Forces. And one time when she was entertaining, there was a battle going on, and she went to the aid station to take care of the wounded, and one of the medics said, "Ma'am, we've got to get you out of here. You can't be here. You're in danger." And she said, "Young man, I'm a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve Nursing Corps. You take me to the nearest doctor." And we loved her. This is an incredibly important issue, and I will be as quick as I can. In 2002, I was responsible to Lieutenant General McKiernan at Camp Doha in Kuwait during the ramp-up for the war in Iraq to write the fratricide policy. Fratricide is blue on blue, or when you hit the wrong target with the right ordnance and you injure, wound, or kill your own people. When you do that, that's considered a mission fail. And two, it is detrimental to the morale of those troops that are fighting on the ground because they are hoping that you're going to get it right. That was an extraordinary program. I worked with some great people, and we had the lowest fratricide during OIF-1 since Desert Storm. Was particularly significant. The reason that I'm wearing the decorations that I was awarded is because sometimes I have found in the past that veterans are not seen as veterans. You see suits and ties, you see dockers and sports jackets, but you don't see the physical manifestation of somebody who has served and served the nation, and that's why I wear this. The bill that is before you now is absolutely needed. I meet with veteran VA across the Pacific Northwest, the Pacific Rim, Hawaii, Alaska, in the work that I do. I went through the VA programs, and I get all of my care at the VA. And I can tell you that the VA in Oregon is broken. It's understaffed, underfunded, under-resourced. It is having significant problems across the board, and I submitted several articles specifically on Oregon that are recent as to what the problems are. When it comes to chemical dependency and psychiatric issues, it's almost non-existent. You have one hospital that has in Roseburg, VA, that has a 20-bed unit for chemical dependency. That's it. The outcome of this is that we have the highest suicide rate for Oregon National Guard in the country, for the National Guard. Same with veterans that have given up because they can't get services. The VA itself is in, as I said, turmoil. It's a form of fratricide. We know what to do. We know what the problem is. But we aren't taking the necessary swift measures to try to bring more people into the partnership that has to exist to take care of our active duty, our National Guard, and our veterans, and the military family members. We are on the verge of continuing warfare. The fleet is off the coast of North Korea. We just dropped the largest bomb we have in the inventory on ISIS in Afghanistan today. We're in Syria. It is not going to stop. And Oregon lags behind, regardless of what you are told, in terms of providing sufficient resources for chemical dependency and psychiatric issues. This is not a market share issue. I've done my research. I've read the stuff there. This has nothing to do with market share. It has nothing to do with competing hospital corporations. It has nothing to do with the special interests and the agendas that people have that hopefully they'll be honest enough to bring to the table if they're going to speak here today in front of you. This has to do with saving lives. Saving lives. Working with the VA, which the bill says, you have to contract with the VA. Believe me, working with the VA is a challenge and a war in and of itself. And you have to work with the DOD because you do have active duty people here that require these services. And the guidelines and the standards and the demands are so much higher than the civilian requirements for chemical dependency and reporting and things like that. It's just unbelievable. So you're not going to see a whole lot of people that are going to come in and want to do that. There's an easier way to make a psychiatric and a chemical dependency buck, quite frankly. So this is about taking care of veterans. This is about taking care of service members and military family members, and they are dying, and they are dying daily. And the problem is so bad, and I have seen this in my previous work before Cedar Hills, where veterans that have been turned away from services at VA have gone out to their cars, gotten in their cars, and killed themselves in the parking lot. You can Google these stories. It is their last great act of defiance. Thank you for your service. You folks have the opportunity to make a significant change over a two-year period because there's a new VA sheriff in town and he is cleaning house. He just fired the director in Washington, D.C. at the VA for gross malfeasance. And that's coming across the board. But the VA needs time to get itself together and get the staff in and get retrained and do the job that they're here to do for us. So I urge you, I plead with you as somebody who went through a significant change of life and got back in the workforce and dedicated his adult life to making sure that other people don't have to go through what I went through. Look at this bill carefully. Ignore the private agendas. Let's take care of our own and set a standard. You can set a standard for the rest of the country in terms of shortcutting getting services in that can be properly managed, licensed, certified. You can do that. Or we can go down the same road that we're on, watching our men, women, brothers, sisters take their lives or disappear off the map over in Central Oregon, living out in a homeless camp because no one cares. And we know that's not true. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, anyone? Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it, Rick. I have two individuals that are signed up. There are more than 100 miles away. I think it's Brian Hennaday. Is that right? Okay. Brian Hendricks, and Mike
Verdunk.
Okay. Yeah, all right, is anybody going to come up, both of you? Is there anyone with you? Yeah, so you come with him, too. Okay, come on. That's fine. All three of you can come up. And then from that, we're going to move, after that, your testimony, we're going to move over to Representative Kenemer. You have a few minutes?
So for the record, Brian Hendricks. I am former Navy veteran. I flew search and rescue, Gulf War. I've basically dedicated the last several years of my life to veteran service organizations, none the likes of Higher America's Heroes, Wounded Warrior Project, who I'm working with now. I am not necessarily speaking on behalf of them. This is my personal advocation, I guess is the best way to describe that. And I have personally had experience with veterans and the lack of care that they're provided in the area that have committed suicide. And so my heart is in this as well. And anything you guys can do to continue and allow this bill to passage, I would greatly appreciate. And we'll let the two other gentlemen with me give their piece, and we'll be here for questions after.
I'll make it short as well. My name is Gary Cashman. I'm a combat veteran, OIF, OEF, served with 2nd Ranger Battalion for Special Forces Group as well, and I've known Greg through work as well. I also as well work at the Wounded Warrior Project, OASIS Group, which takes care of Special Operations veterans as well. And just want to speak on the behalf of, daily for me, through what I've got to see at work and what I've dealt with in my own problems, the ability to have care anywhere at any time is really important. I've dealt with numerous suicide calls from Oregon from what I do with Wounded Warrior Project, and it's painful to hear gentlemen's call you up, full-grown gentlemen crying on the phone and not able to access help. I've seen great care given to some facilities that we have here in Oregon, where they've got folks coming in from all over the world and getting treatment at a civilian care facility and watching it do great things for people walking out of here. I've seen a gentleman come in on a plane on crutches, go visit him 2 months later, and he's doing fine, standing upright, walking, as care given to, provided by a civilian entity. I look at like the VA as a gym membership. If every member of a gym went into the gym, there would be no equipment to use. The VA is starting to get that way now. They were not meant for everyone to come in for care. Looking at partnering with other agencies, looking at airlines, they partner with other people to get more people on flights, to provide more care and offer more facilities for people to go use. You can equate those to the same thing. But to have a guy that might be 2 hours from here needing help on the phone, can't get in a car to drive somewhere, he's got to drive all the way up to Portland and then get a turnaround of a 2 week wait time or a 2 hour wait time on a phone to get access to suicidal help. It's not fun taking those calls, and it's not fun finding out later on that somebody's actually committed suicide because they couldn't get the help they needed to make it in. I was able to do some CPR for a couple hours on the phone, but it's not enough. Just the ability to have care anywhere they need to, as long as it's proper care, and not having to go to one sole source is a great thing for people to have access to.
And my name is Mike Verdunk. I am an Army veteran. I was in for 14 years. I served a number of tours overseas in Iraq, and I was a Bradley crew member and a chaplain assistant. But my experience, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself, I used to work for the substance abuse program for the Washington Army National Guard at Camp Murray, right by Joint Base Lewis-McChord. And one of the most common issues I saw was soldiers needing inpatient care for substance abuse issues, and the beds being full, essentially. And it's especially problematic because I think for service members in substance abuse clinics or with substance abuse issues, they also often struggled with PTSD, which compounded their problems, which was just a reminder of how badly and how quickly care needed to be provided to these warriors. So because of all the different experiences they had to be taken care of, and those resources were often not available to them. So we were scrambling, calling different states, whether it was Idaho or Oregon, trying to find them some care, trying to find an alternate treatment facility for them to go to. But oftentimes, it took weeks or even months for these warriors to get to a proper place to get help. So that is my experience.
And we don't want any of these comments to be construed as we don't appreciate and or love the VA. We are working diligently on a personal level as well as our corporate office to partner with the VA to figure out where the gaps are, to work with them on the gaps, and it's going to take time. It's going to take time for us to learn. It's going to take them time for the new administration to step in, and so it's not a partnership we're giving up. It's not a partnership we're walking away from. It is something we're actively pursuing as well. So this is by no means meant to be a hit on them. This is a stopgap, a situation where over the next 24 months, if we can help in any way in the state of Oregon, we would love to see that.
Questions? Comments? I do have a question. Because all three of you are military veterans, and you know, the three of us are all military veterans, and we've been at war for 16 years, and I've been in the legislature for 12 years, and I unfortunately have not seen it get any better. I mean, you have observation. I mean, you were in sounds like the Washington Guard, and everything else like that, and you were in the group, and it's like okay, we always say, you know, help's on the way, the QRF's moving, but I haven't seen a lot of movement. I mean, I'm not as kind as you are to the VA, I hate to say that. I mean, I'm just looking for a reaction. You would think in the 3 years military services, when we had problems, we tried to do something, but we've been at this for a long time, and we've not seen any results. Any thoughts?
I personally would think that, I think just the understanding of what goes on with PTSD, mental health issues, what does it go from, like, when you're in? We don't like to say that we're hurting.
Right.
A lot of guys are afraid to get out because they want to move on in their careers. I do employment for Wounded Warrior Project, so I see this a lot of times. I don't want to say I have PTSD because I'm trying to get a job at the FBI or local federal law enforcement stuff. Guys hide things, and they mask it, and they mask it with alcohol, and they mask it with other things. We've learned to take – I've talked about in the van right over here. We've learned to take fear and cover it with anger. That's what the military teaches us to do. They don't teach us how to undo it when we get out. And then it manifests. And then when you're too far away from help, it's not reachable. As far as the VA goes, they're just really slow at learning what needs to be done. I'm going to say that I would think some of the doctors aren't military related, so they kind of take it at their own pace. And like Brian was mentioning, we're trying to work with the VA to make them a little more educated and hold them a little bit more accountable to services. But I think, like you said, it's slow for people just to understand it. I don't think, unless they've kind of felt it or felt the burden of it with either another family member or a brother or sister in arms, it's hard to understand how much help they need and how immediate they need the help. You don't have 3 weeks to sit there and go, yeah, chill out, relax a little bit, calm down, put the gun out of your mouth. We'll get you in a couple of days. The VAs need to really realize that when somebody turns around, like Greg said, someone goes to the VA, and we've had one of our warriors as well go to the VA, get turned away for help, go to the car, and we get an email saying that someone's pulled the trigger. It is a horrible feeling at work to know that we weren't able to save one person. For the VA to speed up a little bit and realize when people come for help, they need to get the help as soon as possible or get them connected to somebody that has the help available to them for even that day. One day may have life or death difference between somebody else. So that's my take on it.
Yeah, I guess also what I would say is don't mistake our partnership and or our patience for acceptance. It's something that we know needs to change, and we're driving as hard as we can from our individual perspectives as well as the corporate offices of the veteran service organizations that we work for to assist and to help and to drive. So.
Good. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. Representatives, you want to join us, please? Welcome to the madhouse of the first session deadline.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Indeed, I would concur. Good diagnosis. For the record, I am Bill Kenemer, State Representative, District 39, and would note, with regard to this bill, also a retired psychologist, and have some particular concern, and I'm glad to see this bill before us. I'll make just a few bullet points. There's a lot that could be said. You've heard a lot, and there's more, I'm sure. I was startled to just learn that the Mental Health America ranks Oregon 49th out of 50 states in providing mental health services for those who need it. That was pretty shocking. The Oregon Health Authority estimates there are upwards of 40,000 Oregonians with severe and ongoing mental illness, yet Oregon has fewer than 800 beds available specifically for psychiatric care. Also, the governor's proposed budget would eliminate 174 more psychiatric beds at the Junction City Hospital. And in the Tri-City Portland metro area, the hospitals have inpatient psychiatric beds. The hospitals that have inpatient psychiatric beds had an average occupancy of over 86% in the most recent data, which means they are at capacity. According to a recent study done by Oregon State University, almost one out of every four severe psychiatric visits to an emergency department in Oregon results in what they call boarding. This means they don't have psychiatric units available, so they put them in standard hospital rooms, often locking them in for their own safety. Without psychiatric services particularly available, they're just held there and fed and kept. So the real issue behind this bill is that it exempts hospitals reimbursed by the U.S. Veterans Affairs from the requirement of obtaining a certificate of need from OHA. And this is very important because that process can take years. And this bill would allow essentially this process to be dramatically sped up and to add such facilities to VA facilities quickly. And that means better service. And as you've just heard in testimony, there are many deserving service veterans and military personnel who need this kind of immediate treatment. I think this is a great bill. I think there are a lot of people in need of intensive treatment, and mental health beds need to be put online. And this is a bill that will help do that. So I urge your support.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Boquist and members of the committee. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative for House District 7, which includes Roseburg. The concern that veterans have and have testified here is very compelling. It's an immediate concern that we have, and when we look at the history of Certificate of Need, one of the reasons I was asked to come in, the Certificate of Need used to be more expansive to where even getting a dental x-ray in the state of Oregon would require a fee and a Certificate of Need review. Now, some of those regulations have been rolled back, but there was a point in time that this was a broader program and incorporated more health services, and they have rolled some of those Certificate of Need services back over the years. And as that has rolled back, I don't think that there was any concern or problem with these other entities that used to be included in the Certificate of Need that has hurt them. So looking at the whole concept of Certificate Need, my concern with it is the cost and the barriers that we have with the Certificate of Need and the requirement in the application that you basically have to go out in faith and invest a significant amount of money for one of these facilities and then get the Certificate of Need to where you would have a cost of, you know, a lot of money, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars invested into the program depending on the size of the facility that you want. And so I think it's important to have this conversation. I know on the House side we will be having a informational discussion about Certificate of Needs after the deadline, but this bill would just take a point in time where we could have a discussion of letting facilities free of the obligation of having to meet with all the requirements in the Certificate of Need so we could more quickly get the services that we need to our veterans. And I thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, and a member of the House Veterans for many years, as much as the Chair Boquist has been on the Senate side and the House side. Just to give you an idea of that cost of Certificate of Need application, the fee alone for a $1.5 million facility is almost $35,000. And for a $10 million facility, the application fee is over $70,000. So we're talking some serious money. As we grow older, we Vietnam veterans especially, we have a lot of people that never ever went back to society. They went out in the woods and they're here physically, but they're not here mentally. They're still in country mentally. As they come out and as they start needing health benefits, we're going to have more and more of a drain on our system because these people do need help, and they still suffer from PTSD. So the things we're doing today will help each and every person, not only people, but the veterans as well. And the veterans are very, very special to me because, you know, they've never asked for anything, but they're always grateful for what we allow them to have. So I would ask for your strong support for this.
Questions? Gentlemen, I have a question for you because all three of you are businessmen. I've got veterans here. And we all, three of us have, I think, the same opinion, or four of us have the same opinion of the Federal Veterans Administration and how far behind they are. But it would just seem logical from a state business point of view, if someone was providing an opportunity to fill that need and the federal government's going to reimburse it, does that make sense to you as a businessman that we should help our veterans that way, that, you know, we should let somebody else, we wouldn't have to pay for it, we wouldn't have to have VSOs? It just seems common sense to me that we'd go out and say, hey, someone else is willing to provide this service and the federal government will reimburse it. We don't have to legislate VSOs and put them on cases and everything else. It just seems like the right thing to do.
Mr. Chair, I think I'd like to handle that. And what I would handle it by saying, just like I said with the 2%, we wanted to do lottery funds. We ended up with 1.5%, and the question was, why would we do that? Because the federal government should be doing that. And my response to that is, it's our people.
Gentlemen?
Yes, thank you for the question. I think it's very clear that we ought to enableize our systems here in Oregon to take full advantage to benefit our veterans as much as possible. One of the things that I was involved with was working with dual eligibility under the Medicaid waiver system, where we will have some hopeful benefits that we can extend to our veterans in that area. So that's an area that I worked with. On this side of it, why wouldn't we try and take advantage of that?
Thoughts, Doc?
Hey, Mr. Chair and members, you know, when somebody's offering money, we probably ought to take it. I think that's a given. And secondly, you know, it's been demonstrated well just a few minutes ago, there's a huge need here. And red tape is one of the things that probably annoys us more than almost anything. And this bill is about eliminating red tape so that something can be done in a speedy fashion. I think it's a no-brainer.
Thank you, gentlemen. With that, we will... Mario Bolivar and Libby. Do you have anybody with you?
It's Mario.
Okay. We have three chairs. And I'll break tradition, Mario, and I'll let you lead. And so, normally we let ladies go first, but since you're odd man out of the three-person panel, being politically correct here, yeah, I do learn things, Greg.
Well, Chair Boquist and members, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. My name is Mario Bolivar, and I'm the director of the military program at City Hills Hospital. And I'm here to ask you for your support of Senate Bill 1054. And you've heard a lot of comments from Greg, and you know the folks from the Wounded Warrior Project, from others about the great need. I see that need every day. We opened the doors in 2009 at Cedar Hills Hospital, and we've seen hundreds and hundreds of military service members and veterans come through our doors, saving lives, individuals who were really hurting because of combat trauma, military sexual trauma, with dual diagnoses, with substance use issues that have just been destroying not only their lives, but their families, their children, their extended families. We've seen veterans come to us in Oregon from all throughout the state, from the coast, from Astoria all the way down to Coos Bay, up and down, from Central Oregon, from Eastern Oregon, from Southern Oregon, from Portland, from Vancouver, who come to us who are homeless, who are hurting. I saw a veteran last year who had been living out in the woods for the last 10 years. He had never gone to the VA, and he had just had a heart attack. And he was told, you have about 2 months to live unless you leave that area you're in and you go into treatment. He was recommended to us. He came to us. He loved being outside. He only stayed with us for 2 weeks, and I urged him to get additional care, and I gave him my card, and he left. And he calls me back 3 months later and said, Mario, can I still come back? And he came back, and we got him connected. Not only did he get better, not only did he work through his substance use issues, mental health issues that he was battling, but we got him connected, and he's now living in a residential program, getting the kind of physical care that he needs, getting the mental health care that he needs, and that's what we do. That's what our interest is. And so I urge you to vote for this bill because of the comments that you've heard here today. You know, I've dedicated my life and my wife to basically serving others. We've adopted medically fragile children. We have a son whose dad was in Vietnam, and he lived for the first 2 years of his life at OHSU. And so that's when we adopted him, and he's 37 years old, and he's never ate by mouth. He's gastrostomy fed. He is got a trach, so he can't breathe on his own. And I see what sometimes the war does to our bravest, to our individuals that serve this country to protect us, our freedom that others don't have. So I urge you to vote for this bill because the need is there.
Thank you. Adam?
Good afternoon. My name is Elizabeth Hutter, and I'm here to support a Senate Bill 1054 or 1054. I'm the Chief Executive Officer at Cedar Hills Hospital and Outpatient Services. Just in case folks don't know, it's a freestanding psychiatric hospital up in the Portland, Oregon area. And we are uniquely positioned to comment on this bill because of things that Mario has just said and other members that we know that are here today, and also because we specifically treat veterans, family members, and service members in our military program. Additionally, we also treat members of the general public for mental health and substance use disorders in our hospital units and our outpatient programs. And So folks have a little bit of background about why we're commenting on it. We're an 89-bed inpatient adult and a large outpatient program that offer day treatment and intensive outpatient program. We opened in 2009, as Mario said, and we were under a different ownership. Now we're owned by Universal Health Services, and they actually have Patriot support programs across the United States, and we're actually one of the centers of excellence. And I think it's important, and I'm really here today just to talk about the need that we're seeing for inpatient services for veterans, family members, and active duty service members. And I have a few numbers and statistics I'd like to share with everyone just that we've been able to gather from our own experience working with these folks who are in such great need. And I use our experience in our high occupancy within our own hospital as a barometer for the continuing need for inpatient mental health and substance use treatment for our veterans and community members in the state of Oregon. Cedar Hill is open with just 36 inpatient beds, actually, and we have grown to 89 beds over the last 7 years. During this time, our capacity has consistently been at 90% to 95%. And we've actually had a 10-bed expansion on our most acute unit, and that was at capacity within 24 hours of opening. And I looked back at the historical data, and even I was surprised to see that within 24 hours of opening, it was our most acute psychiatric unit, and it was full. We are continuously overwhelmed by the number of veterans and community members who are seeking treatment on a daily basis. In the past 12 months, the hospital has seen a dramatic increase in the number of veterans seeking care through the CHOICE program. We've actually established an extremely collaborative relationship with the VA, and we're treating an average of 9 veterans per day in the hospital. Over the holiday months, I was looking back at this, and we were actually seeing over an average of 15 veterans per day in the hospital, and these are just with varying lengths of stay. And there needs to be a mechanism for quality treatment programs to be open at all times and have availability at all times for veterans who are seeking emergency inpatient mental health and substance use treatment, which we're not seeing now. People, as many people here today have said, people are waiting in emergency departments. And I have a few numbers to share around what we're seeing and the requests we're seeing for treatment coming from emergency departments around the entire state of Oregon and even sometimes from Southwest Washington. Due to Cedar Hills being at capacity most of the year, we're unable to treat an average of 128 Oregonians per month, which is a combination of veterans and community members. Unfortunately, I don't have those numbers broken out. In total, we receive about 222 requests to accept clients, veterans from emergency rooms, and community members from emergency rooms across the entire state. And we are only able to accept about 104 of those clients. So that gives you an idea of how many people are left sitting, and that's just our experience at Cedar Hills. So I request the members of the committee to consider how important it is for our state to allow more inpatient psychiatric programs to open without the barrier of the certificate of need process and have them be a part of treating veterans, service or veterans, family members, and active duty service men and women. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Broquist, members of the committee, my name is Molly McGrew. I'm president of State Street Solutions, and I represent Universal Health Services. I'm here mostly speaking on behalf of my own experience as the daughter of a Vietnam vet, the niece of a Korean vet, and the granddaughter of World War II veterans. And I think that one of the most significant things, having experienced living with family members who have been in the military as a child and grandchild and niece, is over the years the things that you pick up on, the subtle ways in which life can be overwhelming for them and how they choose to adapt or not adapt to that. Even within my own family, one of those individuals did commit suicide because there was no access to treatment or services at the VA, and this was in Sacramento, California. My dad, when I was young, at times I could come home after school, and if he was there, home from work, I could see him watching the military channel. And it was for many years that I did not realize that one of the components of PTSD in veterans is an obsessive need to do that. So for me, I feel great pride representing Universal Health Services and the programs that are offered specifically at Cedar Hills Hospital. I do wish those would have been things that my family member could have had access to, but certainly it has been a great experience to be part of their community. Thank you. I hope you'll support Senate Bill 1054.
I had the opportunity of visiting Cedar Hills Hospital when it was in construction, and then after it was full-blown and seeing patients. I have a question, though. I know this is focused on veterans, but what percentage of your intake is veterans? I mean, how many patients do you see a week? What percentage of that per week are veterans? That's what I was wondering.
And Madam Vice Chair, do you mean folks that we're assessing in our assessment center or folks that we're treating on our inpatient
Well,
units?
Those who actually, I think, are beds that take up beds.
Oh, so
because I know we're focused on veterans, and I was just wondering what percentage.
So it varies a little bit, but especially in the past, I would say since July of 2016, it varies a little bit, but we're treating an average, and this is veterans, family members, and service members, active duty service members all together, somewhere between 20 and at times up to 28 people in our inpatient.
Between 20
units.
And 28 out of the total 89 beds. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. It's kind of interesting. I'm not quite certain how to ask this question, but and it makes me sound kind of dumb, but certificate of need. It's interesting that we have to have a certificate when we know we have the need. Does your facility have a certificate of need?
Our facility does. It went through the certificate of need process. I think it took about 2 years, from 2007 to 2009. I was not employed by the facility at that point, but it did, and it still is under the certificate of need.
Follow up, please.
Please.
Was it? I know you weren't there, and I apologize for this question, but do you know if it was extremely expensive?
To my knowledge, yes, it was extremely expensive. I don't know the exact number. I know from recent experience with the certificate of need process that it's extremely expensive, and that's for a variety of reasons, and not just the fee that I know was discussed a little bit earlier.
Mr. Chair,
please.
I think perhaps we need to reverse the process of certificate of need and give it to our veterans, and they say, I have a certificate and I have a need, and it should be free.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Dale Penn and Paul Crosgrove. Therefore, no, no. What do you mean? Against, you mean? Yeah, last. I would have them come last. I'm hoping they're going to be balanced and not say what they told us last time.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove representing Legacy Health. There is a document filed in OLIS that has been submitted by Legacy, Adventist, OHSU, Kaiser, Providence, and Asante. In opposition to Senate Bill 1054. But I'd just like to start by saying it's not that I think anyone disagrees with the need for services for veterans. The question is how best to provide those. And we have a different view about that than the proponents of the bill. The certificate of need process, while not perfect, I've been familiar with it since back in the 70s when I worked at Multnomah County Public Health, and we were trying to decide what to do with citing a new veterans hospital in Portland. If those of us who've been around here a long time may remember that battle of where it should be and how it should be done and whether we should have served those veterans not in a new hospital specialized for them, but in fact in the community hospitals. And the decision was made to build a new hospital. So there, these issues of how best to provide services to veterans are important. We think the certificate of need process, however, should be applied in this case, as it is in all other cases of hospitals, in order to make sure that we do not build expensive facilities that will eventually come through as cost to all of us in our healthcare system unless they are needed. And as part of that, we look at the alternative ways to provide services. So that's my comment. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Dale Penn. I work for CFM, and I'm here representing Providence Health and Services. As an organization that's strongly rooted in the mission to serve our poor and vulnerable populations, Providence appreciates the work of legislators to ensure the safety of our state's most vulnerable. I just want to also thank the individuals who came up and testified before, and I appreciate their service and their comments. So, first of all, Providence is up here to oppose Senate Bill 1054. The Certificate of Need process, as Mr. Cosgrove had mentioned, it's a long-established regulatory structure that ensures that new facilities fill an actual need in the community. They provide quality health services and foster containment of those health care services. The process requires applicants to make the case that their proposed facility meets the test set out in statute in a transparent way and allows the public to weigh in on that proposal. The process can be complicated, but it's the same process that all hospitals are subject to. Changes to the statute or exemptions for a single facility or type of facility should be the product of a consensus process of all stakeholders so as to ensure a level playing field for all. Providence supports the existing CON process that has been in existence for decades, one that's clear and orderly. So we appreciate the work of this committee, those who have testified, who are focused on the goal of enhancing access and options for Oregon's respected veterans. We look forward to continuing to work with this group on this issue, and we simply believe this proposal does not move us closer to that goal.
What advice, sir?
I've had the opportunity to visit the psychiatric clinic that you have in Oregon City. Providence.
Willamette Falls, the CAPU, the yes. Child and Adolescent. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so is that a part of Willamette Falls? Because it's in a standalone building, and do you know if there was a certificate of needs for that facility?
Yes, there would have had to have been a certificate of need for that facility. They would have had to gone through the same process that the proponents have attempted for their property in Woodburn, and they were successful in that, showing a need for the services in the community.
Okay. And we're working really hard to try to incorporate mental health services as a part of physical health services in our CCOs. I mean, they should all be treated. So I think some hospitals may be better than others in trying to address it, but we still have a need in Oregon to provide access for those who have mental health needs. And I don't know if either of your hospitals, I just know about the psychiatric, but that's in Oregon City. We need a lot of these throughout Oregon, throughout even in the metro area, but particularly in the rural areas. And I know that there should be clinics addressing this, but I was just wondering if you could say what your hospitals are doing.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Vice Chair, Unity Center for Behavioral Health has just opened in Portland. Unity is a combined effort of Portland Adventist, Legacy, OHSU, and Kaiser. All of those hospitals had psychiatric inpatient services. They were all relocated to the building that used to be Holiday Park Hospital, right there by Rose Quarter. And in that move, there were a few fewer, based on need assessment in the community, a few fewer adult beds and a few more adolescent and youth beds added. The net result was no net increase in beds, essentially. But there was an adjustment based on need. The The difference, however, in that facility than any of these other facilities, at least in this state, and we hope it will be a model for others, not only in elsewhere in larger towns and cities, but we'll try to find a way to replicate it in smaller towns and cities, is a 24/7 psychiatric emergency room. Somebody before mentioned the boarding at emergency rooms. It's really a terrible problem in all the hospitals in the state. People come, there's not a place for them to go, and there are no services for them, and they're sort of boarded at an emergency room. It's expensive and it's bad care. This, when you go to the psychiatric emergency services like the one that just opened at Unity this year, you see a psychiatrist and psychiatric nurses and social workers immediately, and treatment starts immediately. The data from places like Alameda County in California is that 75% of the people who come into that system through a psychiatric emergency services never have to have inpatient. They get treated sufficiently and stabilized that they can actually be moved from there to community services, which is better and more likely to be closer to their own home.
And evidence base shows that it's better.
Yes. So there are other models, I guess, as I mentioned. It's not a question of whether there's need for services. It's which services are the best services to provide for most people. That's the question.
Well, we had a bill in the healthcare committee wanting data from hospitals on psychiatric boarding. And I see the Hospital Association in the back smiling, because there's a lot of information that we need from the hospitals on what you are actually doing with our mentally ill and how many are really being boarded. Because once we have that data, then we'll be able to figure out, okay, how can we move the system? How can we make it better? How can we really provide access instead of having one of our veterans be turned away and go in and kill himself right there in the parking lot? I mean, those are the types of things that we have to address, and I just think it's about time we try to be a little bit more aggressive.
If I may, Mr. Chair, just one more item. One other aspect of that new system, it's a totally new system of care, is the entry point is, generally speaking, police and EMS in the streets where people, you can self-admit to Unity. But a lot of people who were used to be picked up and taken to a jail or to an emergency room to be boarded will now be assessed in the field by EMS, and all the EMS services in the Tri-County have been retrained in this, and then brought to Unity, where they'll get psychiatric care, not boarding in an emergency room. So although this program has just started operating this year, in January, we hope and expect to see some dramatic progress. That will be for any number of kinds of members of the community, whether they be on Medicaid, whether they be veterans, whether they be commercial insured, whatever. It's not a specialized facility for a type of patient other than people who have that need.
Senator, thank you very much. You admit there's a tremendous need. We heard from the panel that they opened a specific facility, and within 24 hours it was filled. And we also heard that it took 2 years to get a certificate of need. So my question would be, how many of our veterans do you think would harm themselves or their families or kill themselves in the 2 years it would take to get a certificate of need?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's a difficult question to answer.
It's a difficult question to ask.
I appreciate that. It's because the assumption is, if this certificate of need for this hospital isn't granted, are there no other places for veterans to go? We all read what the veteran system run by our government is doing, or more appropriately, not doing for care. But that's why Unity is one of the exciting things that has happened that will hopefully address that for not only veterans, but for non-veterans and other members of the community. The question is, do we need more inpatient beds? Do we need more community services? Do we need more assessment in the field and diversion from jails? Which level of services is the best way to avoid the results you're talking about? Because it's a tragic result.
Follow up?
Sure.
Thank you. The answer is yes to all of those. We need more in service. We need more in beds. We need more community service. We need it all.
It's kind of an interesting overlap now. The good Senator Mona Sanderson and I are on Human Services together. And there's just been a plethora of discussion about the need for mental health care. And we can bandy it about and chat about it all we want, but it doesn't get the job done. You know, when you're in the military, you're given a job, you're given a specific goal, and they put together the program to do it, and they go do it. That's what we need to do. But when we, as this legislative body, put up roadblocks saying that, whoa, wait a minute, we need to have a certificate of need, we need to go through this bureaucratic process to ask the question if we need it, and you just heard today, there's no question that we need it. We need more on both sides of the aisle, from the veteran side and from just the public service side. We need a ton of it. So the question I ask you is, what is wrong with making a loophole so that we can begin the process to get this help? And as we move forward, look at it and say, okay, this is the solution we can come up with, rather than delaying the entire action.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think we are supporting a process that we believe, while not perfect, helps us spend our health care dollars in the most efficient way for the best result for everybody. That's the process we're resulting. Now, does certificate of need always lead to that result? I expect not. But there needs to be a process to help us determine the best way to spend those dollars to get the most care to the most people. Because obviously, if we waste money on physical plant that isn't necessary at the detriment of other services that are more needed, that doesn't help either. So that's that. The question is, and I'm not the right one to be able to answer that, but the question is how to get to that result. And the result we have chosen since 71 is the certificate of need process for expenditures like this, big expenditures.
Well, let me ask the chair, if you may.
Let me ask some questions. Does Providence or Legacy, either one of you, which one of you has a contract with the Department of Veterans Affairs and TRICARE?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I'm sorry, I should have asked that question, but I can find out and let you know.
I can do the same. I don't know off the top of my head.
Gentlemen, I understand you're in a rock and a hard spot, but here's the point. So just caution's the better part of valor in the military. Right? So it's probably time for the two of you to stop talking. If your entities don't have contracts with TRICARE and aren't in the choice program, then the dollars we're talking about are federal dollars that this legislature has been after for 12 years. It's not any other dollars that are out there. The crux to the issue here is you know, the federal VA and the variety of federal VA support programs, right, don't have beds. And so it's a reimbursement rate, but that's a contractual obligation, which is a public record, even in a nonprofit, and at the federal side. So the question comes back down is, and I'm curious, I want you to follow up to me, does Providence and do Legacy, do they, and it's done this way, you know how this contracting works, do they have a contract either through TRICARE, TriWest, or any of one of the other host of VA entities that actually pays the reimbursement, which was be the entity that's here. So so if you'd check on that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, we can most certainly do to that. Sure.
And now I'm going to turn Senator Olson back loose on you.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you, because you asked a question that I was going to broach. These are federal dollars, and therefore we're bringing federal dollars to our state for care, which would, in fact, free up private dollars to take care of the private side, and the federal dollars could take care of the veterans. And that's my concern, is the fact that we're leaving federal dollars back in Washington, D.C., when we can help our veterans with federal dollars. And to carry on with what the chair said, if you're not connected to that, shame on you.
We will, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we'll find out that information and provide it to you. I think it's fair to say that, certainly speaking for Legacy, we're a system that is known to serve all sorts of people in the community. As our CEO, George Brown, mentions Emmanuel Hospital is really the Cook County General Hospital of the state. We serve more people who have fewer resources of all kinds and greater needs than most other systems. We truly have that as our mission. So although I don't know the answer to the specific question, I'll find that out. I mean, we're very cognizant of the fact that there are lots of needs in the community that need to be served, and we do our best to try to do that.
It's notable, but if you're leaving federal dollars back in Washington, that would be a mistake on your part.
I agree.
But as a veteran myself, you know, we're forgotten, and we shouldn't be. And that's the problem I suffer with, is the fact that we're forgotten, and people don't want to take care of the veterans.
And I agree that's a problem that needs to be addressed, and I
thank you.
Don't disagree at all, sir.
No, I just know that TRICARE, I think, is almost solely limited. I mean, it's limited. People who have TRICARE have limited places where they can go, or facilities that actually accept TRICARE. I should put it that way.
Right.
There are not very many people that will accept TRICARE.
Right. So having a facility.
And I don't know who does and who doesn't.
We'll find out.
Yeah. We'll bring that information back.
Sorry, gentlemen. Bad day.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Felisa and Chris. I know Chris was signed up from NAMI. Chris here?
Oh.
Do you have somebody with you? Chris, you have somebody else with you?
Bob Judeff.
Okay.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins. I'm the political director for the Service Employees International Union, Local 49, and I'm here today to oppose Senate Bill 1054. SAAU has over 65,000 members in the state of Oregon, both who provide care, many of whom who actually have TRICARE services as well. And we believe that 1059 puts our community hospitals in danger. I think the previous folks who testified, we can all agree that there's a shortage of mental health services, period. I think that Chris and Bob, who are up here with me, will address the issue that in the question of inpatient versus outpatient services to receive the care is a critical issue. And when we know outpatient services work better than inpatient services. We also are strong supporters of the Certificate of Need process. Frankly, we believe that the process of Certificate of Need should not be, we should not go on a two-year hiatus. And in fact, we believe that the Certificate of Need process should be expanded to look at facilities that are built closer to other facilities, to include facilities that are clinics and other types of facilities, so that we're using our healthcare dollars more wisely, but we're also putting care where people need it, when people need it, with the most access that they have. Without the certificate of need process, we often can see concentrations of healthcare facilities in high income areas, and movement of those facilities out of low income areas. And other states without the certificate of need process have seen that happen. This bill creates a loophole for 2 years, allowing denied applicants back in. You'll see that in my testimony. I think the issue around the certificate of need process, and we've introduced bills in the past with Senator Mona Sanderson around this issue of expansion, this bill is not limited just to facilities that serve 100% TRICARE. It opens it up to anybody who has a contract with the Veterans Administration, and actually most hospitals do have some sort of contract with the Veterans Administration. Both Legacy and Providence, our members, work at Legacy Health Systems, and they do serve veterans in their rehabilitation program who have TRICARE. And many of our members use facilities, through our security officers have TRICARE, and they use facilities throughout the state. Kaiser has a contract with the Veterans Services Administration. So this opens the door for many, many more hospitals than just hospitals who are serving 100% serving veterans. We have many grave concerns about UHS as an operator in our state. We expressed those concerns during the certificate of need process that the Oregon Health Authority laid out, that we felt that the certificate of need process the state of Oregon was right to deny UHS's certificate of need. We also submitted for the record the certificate of need denial with the state of Oregon that we feel like and highlighted some key points about why that denial happened. So we are not supporting Senate Bill 1054 and in fact would encourage a bill that actually expands certificate of need instead of having it go on a two-year hiatus. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Who's first, gentlemen?
I can go, I guess. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Chris Bonneff. I'm executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. NAMI Oregon is a grassroots membership governed organization with 15 chapters across the state. Our membership and leadership are people with lived experience, and we do include among our membership and leadership veterans and their families. As a side note, I can speak from personal experience. Providence does take TRICARE. We have directed families and individuals there, and a number of hospital systems do. We're constantly working with veterans and veterans' families on access issues. We're here to oppose Senate Bill 1054. If this were very limited to only veteran services and only servicing veterans, we might be here in support, but this bill does not do that as it's constituted. I think earlier testimony highlighted that out of 89 beds mentioned, 20 to 28 were dedicated to veteran services. Where our interest isn't necessarily in those 20 to 28 beds, it's in that interest of those 60 to 70 other beds and what that constitutes and does to our system if we're going to give a blanket exemption for a hospital to do anything it wants, build anywhere it wants, build as many beds as it wants, serve whatever payer it wants, without regard to what that does in terms of the rest of our mental health care system. We do have a detailed certificate of need process in place for a reason. Hospital psychiatric care is our most expensive level of care. It serves the fewest number of people of any treatment environment, and it consumes the bulk of our health care spending on mental health care. If Oregon overbuilds, if we build the wrong care in the wrong place, one of two results is guaranteed. One, we will starve community services that often are more effective, less costly, and actually keep people out of crisis and requiring inpatient care. The other is we may create an economic environment in a particular region where we're simply replacing, locating hospital beds from one place to the other because we've created the economic incentives to drive others out of the business. This has happened in the past, and we've seen that around the state, and it's why some communities are completely bereft of inpatient psychiatric care. Before legislation, it's important to note we just went through a very exhaustive certificate of need process. NAMI Oregon, there was a proposal for a hospital to be built in Wilsonville, 100 beds, a portion of which would serve veterans. NAMI Oregon did not take a position in favor or in opposition to that hospital. What we asked the Oregon Health Authority to do was conduct that exhaustive process. We asked them to focus on 10 particular questions and issues that we felt needed to be answered before approval or denial was given to that particular proposal in that particular spot. Legislation like this, we would ask the same things. Before legislation moves forward addressing something like this, that there are particular questions that at least come up for discussion and that they become accommodated in any final legislation. Among them, why would we allow any hospital an unfettered ability to build? This bill would allow a hospital blanket permission to build whatever it wants, as I said, wherever it wants, to serve whoever it wants, as long as a single bed is contracted with the VA. There are no guarantees for volume of services for veterans, nor would there still be the protections that the certificate of need process affords Oregon to maintain the stability of our behavioral health care system. Why wouldn't we set minimum expectations for the number of inpatient beds that must be developed? This legislation doesn't guarantee, as crafted, this legislation doesn't guarantee more capacity other than what may be proposed for the Wilsonville Hospital, which is not intended to exclusively serve veterans. Again, as drafted, a minimal contract with the VA would qualify a new hospital for an exemption. Why doesn't this bill address our most pressing needs in terms of behavioral health services for veterans? For example, if we're talking about the Wilsonville Hospital, it doesn't help our communities where we really do have a severe shortage of services, such as Central Oregon, Eastern Oregon, Klamath Falls, our communities along the Oregon coast. Roseburg was mentioned. There is no inpatient psychiatric care in Roseburg. You have to go to Eugene or you have to go to Coos Bay to get inpatient psychiatric care. But we're not talking about building there. We're talking about building anywhere. We're not directing the conversation to where we really have the needs in terms of communities that need those services. And if we move forward with legislation like this, why would we not require that these beds be exclusively used for VA services? And if they are to be used for other payers or other purposes, why would we not require them to go through the certificate of need process? This would protect the stability of our current behavioral health care system and ensure that if a hospital wishes to serve people more broadly, that its proposal must undergo critical analysis. These, again, are what we consider critical questions to be asked and to be addressed in any final form of legislation if we move forward with this. I do want to be clear. We are not here opposed to inpatient psychiatric care. In fact, we are in favor of more of it, but it has to be elsewhere in the state. It has to be thoughtfully designed. This is an expensive level of care. And when you invest in this, you must do so carefully and planfully. Otherwise, you will have either intended or unintended consequences on the rest of our behavioral health care system. The bill as crafted right now does not address these shortages. Our fear is that having a blanket exemption for anybody to build anywhere, anything, would actually lead to more shortages of the critical services that we need. In this form, we urge the committee to oppose Senate Bill 1054, and we thank you very much for this opportunity to provide testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. We're a nonprofit advocacy organization in Portland that advocates on behalf of people with disabilities. Our organization and myself personally have spent 30 years advocating to get people with mental illness and chemical dependency problems better services in Oregon. I can attest that this has been a frustrating process. We are a long way from getting to where we need to be. But there's a few things that I've learned along the way, having sat on numerous work groups, governor's commissions, and study groups in order to try to improve services here. And one is that there isn't an endless supply of funds to provide these services. Time and time again, we've been faced with the difficulties of finding the money to create the types of services that people need in all of our communities across the state. One of the struggles that we've had has been tied to our health care needs. There's a ray of hope beginning in the 1990s when Oregon decided to walk down the road of the Oregon Health Plan and developing, changing our Medicaid system so that we could better fund services at a lower cost. You've heard the Oregon Health Authority talk about the triple aim, that we have to be able to not only bring more people into service, get them better service, but it has to be done more efficiently and more effectively, because if we don't do all three of those things, we're not going to be able to provide people with the care that they need. Now, I have seen over these years many, many people suicide. I've seen children suicide. I've seen families torn apart by the effects of mental illness. They call us up. They want help. I've seen veterans in the same situation. These are horrible stories, and we bring those stories to you. We've brought them to you. I've brought them to you for the last 30 years to talk about them. And so I think what I'm trying to get at is that as we've moved along, I think there's been a lot of really good thinking, a lot of good effort by professionals, people with a lot of experience, to try to figure out what's the best way to do this. The certificate of need process is one piece of that. I actually did participate in the certificate of need process with the original Cedar Hills Hospital. I remember the hearings. We had the same types of discussions at that time. It was approved. We didn't oppose it. We said, well, let's see what it can do. That particular facility changed ownership and its business model a few times over the years, finally finding a way as a for-profit organization to have it pencil out. In the meantime, we move forward with additional planning, and in fact, I just was part of a behavioral health collaborative process that looked at how we can improve mental health services in Oregon, get more people what they need, keep people out of crisis, keep people out of having to go to the emergency department or a hospital, which is the most expensive level of care, so that we can get better results for our citizens. I can tell you that Unity was not at any of those meetings. They didn't bring up this particular facility as an answer to the problem that Oregon is facing. It wasn't even considered. In fact, but we had the best experts in the state talking about how we could do this more effectively, and it did not include building a freestanding large psychiatric hospital in the Wilsonville area. I can guarantee you that was not part of the solution that was brought forward. So this particular bill concerns us, because it seems to us that rather than going through a thoughtful planning process in order to determine how we can help the bulk of our citizens improve their mental health and get the services that they need, we have a for-profit organization bringing a bill emphasizing one group of people chooses to serve, which was not emphasized in the certificate of need process. I was there for that. In order to generate what might be a well-deserved but very emotional response to try to come up with a solution that really doesn't fit Oregon. So that's why we're opposing this bill, not because we think services are great for veterans. They're not. Not because we think the VA is great. I don't have an opinion. because I think that we have to look at all the citizens of Oregon in making an important decision about how they can best be served.
Chris, I have a bunch of NAMI supporters in my district, as you well know, and they're all in favor of this. So that's the problem with the grassroots organization.
It is, but it's also part of the issue of not fully understanding the process and all the information. Look, if you couch this is going to give you access to services, yeah, we would be supportive of that. But this isn't that. Not crafted like this. This is, you have a blanket exclusion, and if you have a contract with the VA, you do whatever you want without regard to however it impacts the rest of our mental health care system, regardless of if it's in a community that actually needs services. Again, I don't want to be here saying I would be opposed or we would be opposed if this were limited to just veteran services. It's not. And you have to take into account the totality impact on the system and whether or not, in a blanket exclusion, the state is advocating its role to try to direct those resources where they're needed. And again, Roseburg came up. There are no inpatient services in Roseburg. This bill would not address that. What this bill may do is make an inpatient bed available in Portland so that if I really have a need, we'll stick you in an ambulance and pay a couple grand to ship you up to Portland, right? I understand this is a complex issue, and we would be very pleased to be engaged in a conversation to how to craft this so it does meet the need. I certainly also appreciate if the federal government's willing to pay for it, let's do it. But let's do it in a way that we're not trying to intentionally or unintentionally may jeopardize other elements of our system or not direct services to the communities that aren't being served.
Thank you. Oh, you have a question for that?
I do. This certificate of need was made in 1971. It's an old relict elephant, and we need a racehorse to provide needs for our communities, not only with veterans, with everyone. And it doesn't make sense, and as more things come to light, it's more interesting to figure out what's going on here. But it just seems that, you know, we're willing to push people aside and let people take their lumps as we go through this certificate of need process, the process that was supposed to, and I would coach you, ma'am, in your thing here, that it makes a reasonable access to quality health care at a reasonable cost. In the meantime, people die.
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, what we would say about the certificate of need process, we don't disagree that it needs an update. I think Paul Cosgrove also talked about it needing an update. I think that we have different interpretations of what that update would look like, but absolutely, the certificate of need process is supposed to bring reasonable services at a reasonable cost for our entire communities. As Chris pointed out in his testimony, this sort of limitation, and so this project in particular, which we're talking about the UHS project, and this bill in particular, which has any facility, any psychiatric bed anywhere, doesn't accomplish that goal. So we'd be happy to come back either in the interim or next session and work on a certificate of need update that we feel like does accomplish that goal, that takes into account the community needs assessments, for example, that have happened in every single community in our state, so that we can look area and area by region by region, which both local governments, hospitals, community providers, and community advocates have been involved in developing those needs assessments, including veterans groups throughout the state, to talk about the services that are needed in each community and how we have a certificate of need process that lives up to that. That's also in my testimony. We also are very interested in drawing down more federal dollars on the TRICARE system, and how do we do that in a way that is about quality outcomes and quality care for people that the TRICARE system is able to serve. I think that there's some flexibility in some of the waivers that we have in our state that where we can be much more creative about that, along with CCOs. We're very interested in that as well. The challenge is this bill doesn't accomplish those things.
Thank you.
Very quickly. I asked Mr. Cosgrove how many folks would die in the 2 years.
Yes.
Now, if we take it to the interim and make it another 2 years, that's how many folks are going to die in the 4 years before we can get a certificate of need. That's the question. We need it.
Chair Boquist, may I?
Briefly.
Please.
Senator Olson, whether we build it or not, it's not inpatient that is going to save every life. It's outpatient. It's crisis intervention. It's crisis respite. It's mobile crisis. It's jail diversion. As you said, it's all of it. And this bill doesn't address all of it. And in fact, it doesn't guarantee even access to inpatient. What it just says is that if you have a VA contract, you can bill whatever you want, you can serve whomever you want, and you can do it wherever you want. And so it really doesn't get to that need. And if as I said, we would be very pleased to have that. We would be active participants in that conversation, and we would welcome it, because this is a good discussion. But we have to be here to speak to the bill in this form. And so there maybe is a certain irony to an advocacy group like mine being here opposed to something like this. But it's only because it looks like this. If it looked differently, or if we had the opportunity to make it look differently, we would probably come in favor of that.
Thank you. I'm assuming, are any of the three of you veterans?
Chair Boquist, I am not. My father served during the Korean War in the U.S. Army.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Cameron Smith, Dana Sellover from OHA, and Andy. Back there, Andy. And then that's all I have signed up, but we will probably have a few minutes afterwards if anybody else wants to testify. I think OHA and hospitals want to testify together. And is Cameron still around here somewhere?
He doesn't want to come up.
I'm going to drag him up here anyway. There's a point to that, but I'm not going to ask him to speak yet.
Sure.
Why don't we have the hospitals go first before OHA?
Chair Boquist and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And on behalf of our hospitals, Chair, we appreciate you bringing light and attention to the need to have access for behavioral health services for our veterans. Unfortunately, this bill, as stated, does not accomplish that. What is in question is the process of certificate of need. And that process is a tool that the state uses to protect our limited resources, such as our qualified health professionals, as well as our limited health care dollars. In addition, it prevents market saturation that could create unused health care resources. In Oregon, we have 16 psychiatric hospitals, including Cedar Hills in there. all of which receive TRICARE dollars for the patients that they serve if they're veterans. The association opposes this bill for the following two reasons. It changes the requirements, becomes an unfair burden to hospitals, and it changes the process, it changes the purpose of changing the field and unleveling the field, making one having an advantage over the other. And it is really that latter reason why we are opposing this bill. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Well,
thank you. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I'm Dana Selver. I'm the manager for healthcare regulation and quality improvement at the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here today to provide some information about the Certificate of Need process, which is the program is in my section at the Oregon Health Authority. And you have my written testimony, so I just want to give a couple of highlights. And we've heard a lot about Certificate of Need today, so I'll try not to repeat myself too much, but give a bit of a flyover. The Certificate of Need, as you know, is that regulatory program that's designed to discourage unnecessary treatment in healthcare facilities and other services. As the name implies, it's really a method to evaluate services and facilities considered to certify if there really is a need for that, using a method that is laid out in statute and in rule. Unnecessary investment in unneeded facilities and services might result in building of facilities that are not financially viable, and they might also put financial stress on existing facilities, resulting in higher costs and disruption of the healthcare system. Oregon has had a CN program since 1971. It was most recently updated in 1995, so indeed it is a little bit into the last century. Nationally, 34 states plus Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, the District of Columbia have CN programs, and three additional states have a variation of that. The scope of these programs varies widely, and in Oregon, we do have a very limited. We're one of the most narrowly focused programs nationally. We look at new hospitals only and nursing homes, new nursing homes. So a lot of money, state and federal dollars, is spent on health care. Certificate of Need programs is one of the ways, as you heard today, that the government and the public have a way to have a say in developing the health care systems that they have in their state and in their region. And Certificate of Need requirements don't block change. They basically provide for an evaluation and a conversation and an assessment in case in the case of Oregon, it includes public and stakeholder input. CN really tries to ensure that services are provided in a cost-effective and fiscally responsible manner, and excess capacity from overbuilding results in healthcare price inflation. And that can occur when facilities can't fill their beds when they overbuild, and fixed costs must be met by having higher costs. So if you have a facility with 50% full, then obviously that would be fuller. So that's the need for that. Really briefly regarding the bill and the Dash 1 amendments, there is a reference to expanding capacity, and hospitals actually can, for the most part, expand capacity right now. We don't, Certificate of Need does not look, and as it did in the olden days, at imaging systems and surgery services, and I see some nodding heads. You've probably heard that in the past. It really looks at new hospitals, and a hospital right now could expand their capacity without a certificate of need. We let them send us a letter just to make sure that they're covered, so there's no requirement, but it's really for the most part not required to expand. The bill does have the potential to result in excess capacity and duplication of services. Psychiatric, even inpatient and psychiatric and chemical dependency services without the review of the new hospitals. Within the two-year duration of this act, it could result in an increased number of specialty beds that are faster, cheaper, and easier to build than the facilities providing comprehensive medical services in addition to those inpatient services, which those mental health and behavioral health patients often need. And in some instances,
would you restate what you just said?
That this bill as written,
right,
Chair Boquist, that this bill as written within those 2 years could result in an increased number of specialty hospitals that are faster, cheaper, and easier to build than facilities that offer comprehensive services, which includes medical services for a diabetic or someone with multimorbidity, in addition to their inpatient psychiatric services.
And that is a potential here. In some cases, it might promote overutilization of hospital services when other alternatives might be more cost-effective and beneficial. And thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Do you want to wait? You want to testify or wait? Because I have questions for you. Okay. Any questions for the two? I have a couple of questions. We have 16 psychiatric hospitals. Andy, do you know what the bed status is and what's their utilization rates?
You have roughly 430 beds, approximately, in those 16. I am unfamiliar with the saturation rate, but as we heard earlier, it's about 85%. So we can confirm that number for you.
I'd like to confirm, because we've actually had other testimony, not in this hearing, but elsewhere, that we don't have those beds, that they're full, that there's waiting lists. And the federal VA says there's waiting lists, and they can't do anything along that line. If, you know, I get the, you know, unnecessary treatment purpose, I sort of get that. But if we're 49th in the nation for mental health care, and the good senator to my right and I spent a tremendous amount of effort about three sessions ago getting more dollars and everything else, and we haven't seen any expansion. So any guess of why? I mean, we consistently hear testimony we have for years that we don't have enough mental health care beds. But if hospitals under the present regulatory structure could expand the beds, the mental health care beds they have, any idea why they don't do that?
Well, Mr. Chair, there's a coordination issue, and I think we had a bill, and I can't remember if it was in my committee or in Human Services, where we talked about setting up a system so that we knew where the psychiatric beds were and which were available. And I don't know if you remember that bill or not, but
we just heard it.
What?
Didn't we just hear it and have
in humans in Human Services?
Yeah, and have an advisor
so it was
for
in
the,
human.
The governor?
Yes. Oh, yes. And we. Well, no, not that one. Anyway, okay. It is an issue, and it's a coordination issue, because one hospital doesn't know where maybe there would be a psychiatric bed available, and so they leave them in the emergency rooms, and. And I can't remember even the outcome of the bill, so I'm sorry, but
right.
It is an issue that we're addressing, but it is a lack of coordination among all of the hospitals, and we were trying to set up a system that would provide that.
But we've been, you and I with this committee, have been talking about this for, you know, 8 years now, and they haven't coordinated yet. I'm just pointing that out.
Okay.
Thank you, ladies. I don't think we have any more questions for the two of you. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and my lifelines are leaving. I think it is safe to say we've heard a lot of passionate advocacy on both sides of this issue today, and often not as much attention in the Veterans Committee from these stakeholders and advocates, which I think speaks to the not just the veterans nature of this issue, but much larger issues across the mental health care system and the health care system overall. I appreciate the advocate from testimony and in previous from all of you as legislators and the community in this committee. There are significant needs across the mental health treatment needs and care needs for veterans. Being one out of every 12 Oregonians, but a quarter of all suicides is significant. And that is also mirrored throughout our population of all Oregonians as an underserved need, both across urban and rural Oregon, on mental health care access and treatment. It is not necessarily my expertise on the certificate of need and how that affects the larger systems and resources, both on access, on quality, on the cost containment and bending the cost curve of our healthcare and mental health care system. I would highlight, though, it is a decision in this bill to exempt on that certificate of need. But if we are using that veterans lens, and this is for veterans inpatient treatment beds, if that is the specific need that the legislature wants to drive, we should be clear and specifically dedicate, you know, with that exemption, these resources would need to be dedicated to veterans. That's a similar model that we've had. Well, we have less experience on the hospital side and healthcare side through our skilled nursing facilities in the Oregon Veterans Homes, a similar certificate of need process to establish a skilled nursing facility The legislature has exempted the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs when we have stood up our veterans home, both in the Dalles and now in Lebanon. We would not have been able to site that 150-bed skilled nursing facility in Lebanon, likely, if we weren't exempted from that certificate of need. But those resources are dedicated solely to veterans as a healthcare and skilled nursing capacity. But happy to answer any questions.
Do you recall the vice chair and myself and the leadership of the House committee? We had a work group earlier this session, and we were talking, and specifically Senator Riley was involved in that, and what we're trying to address is, what is the status of the state's coordination in PTSD and in veterans' mental health care? And we sort of came to the conclusion with the experts of the executive branch that we had a long ways to go. We didn't know where we were, and after 16 years of war, we had a long ways to go. Is that sort of the correct characteristics?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, certainly we don't have any direct programs at ODVA, and it is that broader coalition and collaboration across partners that we've heard today. It's happening, and I think we are getting more out of our dollars to provide that better health care and mental health care. But whether it's specifically challenges with access and care through the federal VA or educating providers, timely reimbursement of Fed VA, to those community providers, a lot of complexity that we still have to navigate collaboratively, whether for post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, or other impacts for the cross generations of veterans.
Thank you, Director. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on SB 1054? No takers. Let me put a couple things on the record just so we have them. One of the testimony that was presented before was, of course, the police training to identify mental health care issues and be able to direct into mental health care resources. Just for the record, this committee's had previous testimony that so far that program has been an utter and dismal failure. It is being improved, and there's a plan to rework it and get it going. And I want to thank OHA for taking that and the Bureau of Police Standards and Training working to take that program. So that program really doesn't exist in any meaningful matter whatsoever. I have a very interesting, we've actually heard testimony in here before from mental health care professionals in terms of the veterans' ability that the state of Oregon's mental health care system for veterans is not stable. It's a dismal, if not abysmal, attempt at this point. Several of the things, as we've pointed out, we're 49th in the nation, and I still don't have an answer of, you know, why. If we're short beds, and we are, I mean, that's just a fact. I hear that from volunteers. We see it across the board. We've even heard it from the Federal Veterans Administration themselves. Why the hospitals haven't stepped up yet, or somebody else hasn't stepped up to build this. But the veterans I'm hearing for are on the opposite side of the establishment, and at least 68% of my district don't think much of our healthcare delivery system at all, and it's not getting the direction we're supposed to go. There were some things that were inaccurate here that I would have called out, but we'll probably have another opportunity to do that. I don't think there's any doubt that we don't have enough beds. Maybe they're not in the right places. Won't disagree with that. But then the director would tell us, trying to figure out where the veterans are at, we don't know. Growing number of veteran suicides from the Vietnam era, and even faster growing from the Afghan-Iraq war. You send anybody to combat four or five times when all your psychologists told you were stupid to do it, at least in 2005, and we continue to do it for 11 years, is a recipe for disaster in our communities. There's not much we can do about that. But any thoughts, colleagues? I appreciate everybody's testimony. We'll take all of this under consideration, and with that, we'll close the public hearing on 1054. We'll roll it over to Tuesday. Colleagues, that doesn't leave us very much on the calendar, really, on Tuesday. There's a fill bills we're still waiting from to see what the House does so we can determine what to do on the House side. Madam Vice Chair, we'll get together later. Anything for the good of the order? No. With that, we'll close the Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness.